Were the Nazis modern-day prophets of Baal, the biblical demon idol of the Canaanites and other neighbors of the ancient Israelites? Was the Nazi green ideology a precursor to the modern environmental obsession of many? Stay tuned for my conversation with Mark Musser about his book, Nazi Oaks, The Green Sacrifice of the Judeo-Christian Worldview, in this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Hi, folks. Thanks for tuning in to this episode. I'm very pleased to announce that Soaring Eagle Radio is now heard on two additional platforms, Deception Detection Radio Network and Truth Be Told Radio Network. So thank you to Kay and to Kevin for blessing me and the Soaring Eagle Radio listeners with these new opportunities to reach people with our content. Soaring Eagle Radio is also heard on the Global Star Radio Network, Talk America Radio Network, Worldview Weekend Radio Network, Prepper Broadcasting Network, and of course we're on the Objective Radio Network and our own platform, SoaringEagleRadio.com. Mark Musser is a graduate of Evergreen State College and Western Seminary. He and his family are missionaries to, shall we say, the former Soviet Union. Mark pastors Grace Redeemer Church. He's the author of Nazi Oaks, The Green Sacrifice of the Judeo-Christian Worldview, which is the subject of our conversation today. And you can follow Mark. He's on Facebook, and I believe he's on Twitter as well, but we'll let him clarify that. Welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Are you on Twitter, Mark?
I am not. No.
Okay. So don't look for him on Twitter, folks.
No, I don't know anything about Twitter. So.
Okay. So wouldn't be any sense on being on there then.
Yeah, no. I at this point, I haven't looked at it, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, no worries, brother. Nazi Oaks, The Green Sacrifice of the Judeo-Christian Worldview in the Holocaust. Mark, the word Nazi is used most often in our culture today in a pejorative sense by people with a political axe to grind, and it seems like very little conversation uses the word to introduce concepts or ideas that those who subscribe to national socialistic party worldview thinking taught. So it might be surprising to some of our listeners to learn that the Nazis were actually Greens in the sense that environmentalism was a central concept in their worldview. When people hear Nazi, they naturally think of the murder of millions. They think of their anti-Semitism, of their cultish preoccupation with perfecting the Aryan race as they defined it. So maybe we should start there, Mark. How did you discover this truth that environmentalism was a central focus and belief of the Nazis?
Well, I would not call environmentalism a central belief. I would call it an undercurrent, but it's a powerful one.
Yes.
Broader concepts of National Socialism was social Darwinism and its relation to biology and science, and the fact that they believe that nature teaches racism. And part of being a master race is that they wanted to go back to the purity of nature to get rid of what they consider to be the Judeo-Christian worldview that was harboring the weak. It was polluting the blood because we're helping people that are weak. This is helping to, in their minds, propagating all kinds of problems inside the culture. They really took blood almost literally, in the sense that culture really comes from race. It comes from blood. And the weaknesses of that we see in society, rather than blame the fall of mankind for such things, they blamed things like Jews and Christians for such things, and Christianity in particular, because, in fact, they blamed the Jews and the Christians for this, because they believe that the Apostle Paul, for example, made Judaism universal in Christianity. So their idea was to get back to nature, and this was primarily understood under a social Darwinist umbrella, the idea that Germany especially is the vanguard of social change in a good sense as we get back to science and nature. Underneath that, they had also environmental views that were very strong coming out of the early German Green Movement that lasted, you know, well over 100 years before National Socialism absorbed it into its worldview. So environmentalism was really not a movement as we understand it today. We're talking about some different figures, different people who had different ideas about nature. One of those primary, what we would call a movement, a green movement perhaps, but they didn't call it that back then, the 1800s, they called it romanticism, the idea of a romance with nature, that I'm going to have an interest in nature, I want to worship nature, I love nature, I want to get back to nature. And romanticism really goes back to the 1800s, and this was what flowered underneath German history.
Very, very interesting. So you mentioned a lot of different phrases, words, keywords, really, that I picked up on, Mark. Now, one of those things, so let's start here. The Nazis were social environmental Darwinists.
Okay, we could say that. They love nature because Darwinism, of course, Charles Darwin came up with the idea of evolution, the idea that man is not made in God's image, really. He is a product, byproduct of nature through evolutionary blind chance and time. Man is what he is. So they believe that mankind was progressing, and the only way to explain this is by evolutionary lenses. Of course, they had already rejected supernatural causes and supernatural understanding of history or of time or of creation, so Jews and Christians were not part of that discussion. And they believed that Germany was leading the vanguard of the white man to all kinds of progress. And so this was something that was very heady, something very valued in the 1800s, and it continued in the 1900s as well. And this social Darwinism also wanted to use environmentalism as part of its platform, because if you want to have a clean race, you need to have a clean environment. So these things both went together in a very interesting and very dangerous and explosive way.
Now, you mentioned a man named Ernst. Is it Haeckel?
Haeckel, yes. I mean, yeah. Some of these German names I can't pronounce correctly to be a real German. But yeah, Haeckel, he was a famous evolutionist. You know, he followed Darwin very closely, but he, of course, interpreted for German consumption, so there are some changes. He's not a strict Darwinist, but still many ideas were borrowed for Darwin. And he also coined the term ecology in 1866.
Ecology. Now, there's an interesting term.
Ecology. Yes, but he coined the term.
Okay, and we hear that often today, don't we?
Yes, we do. As social Darwinism really is the birthplace of what we call ecology. And in the old days, for example, before World War II, in the 1800s, you had racism and environmentalism together. And in particular, the German people emphasized German race and German land, blood and soil, German blood in their own soil. And this what they believed they were indigenous to their own environment. Jews were international, almost like hucksters. They come from the outside. They're aliens. They also viewed Slavs in very similar fashion, a little bit not as badly as the Jews, of course, but they viewed themselves as superior to both of them. And so what you see in the 1800s, early 1900s, is this amalgamation of racism and environmentalism. After the war, what we see is no longer the racism, because the people could not defend this eugenics, you know, the blood and the biology and the genetics that Nazism emphasized anymore because of what happened in World War II. It was so horrific. So after the war, the environmental movement started emphasizing overpopulation. So when you hear overpopulation, that really is sort of the post-World War II presentation of environmentalism working together with really an anti-humanism, which is what we have today. So now it's people in general. It's not a particular race that's a problem. But this doesn't mean we've progressed any. We still have bad attitudes that are incorrect, and they are not very helpful, to say the least. And these problems are still with us today in many ways, as environmentalism is becoming extremely anti-human in many ways. And, of course, it's also anti-Christian as well.
Yes, absolutely. So now social Darwinism, and let's follow this thinking just for a while longer, Mark, and develop this just a little bit more, because I heard you say that social Darwinism followed evolution. It was like twin tracks for the same train leading back to nature. Now, where does because that sounds a lot like monism. Where does that fit in anywhere?
Well, precisely, because Ernst Haeckel was the father of what we call modern monism. And monism is one, emphasizing oneness rather than the fact that man is made in God's image. He's a dualistic creature. He represents God from heaven, but he's also a creature of the earth. And monism, there's no longer any reference to any outside interference, especially God. And so in monism, oneness, you have this holism, you can call it that too, that, you know, monism is holism. Ernst Haeckel was a primary figure in developing what we call the Monist League in the 1800s. He was also very political. So when we talk about social Darwinism, we're talking about the application of Darwinist principles to society. The Nazis didn't call it social Darwinism, they called it politically applied biology. Haeckel didn't call it social Darwinism, he called it monism. Social Darwinism is monism. That's what it is.
Yeah. Give that phrase again, Mark. You said it was politically applied what?
Politically applied biology.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's how they see. Well, once you reject the supernatural and the biblical worldview, okay, all you have is nature to help you see. And if you want to explain the world in which you live in, and of course they tried to do it scientifically, but they use strictly the world itself as the arbiter of all meaning. And then if you use nature itself as the only arbiter of meaning, okay, you're left with the social Darwinism, the laws of the jungle, survival of the fittest. And then if you base your ethics upon this, you're in deep trouble, which is precisely what the Nazis did. And so these things are rooted in, a fallen nature that can only produce fallen results. And if your science is based on a world that's fallen, the conclusions you come up with are going to be fallen. And this is part of the whole problem with regard to science in the 1800s, especially.
Yes. Yeah. Now, you also mentioned romanticism. Now, that's a philosophy, folks, and that played a major role in the rise of the Nazis' green ideology. I would dare say even a theology. It was faith-like in a sense. So what role did Romanticism play in this, Mark?
Yeah, Romanticism is almost like a natural theology, very pantheistic. It did not believe that God was outside of nature, because they believed that if God was outside of nature, he's not going to care about it that much. This is part of the criticisms of Christianity, and even the Jews in the 1800s, the Romantics, blamed the Jews, particularly Genesis chapter 1, because in Genesis 1, man is made in God's image. He's above nature. Adam names all the animals. He is commanded by God to subdue and fill the earth. And, of course, originally that original plan that God had was made Adam and Eve, and then he planted a garden, and then he told them subdue and fill the earth. And the idea was they were to convert the wilderness into a garden. And of course, we know after Adam and Eve sinned, things changed. Nature is now fallen. Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden. So we really can't recover that Eden existence that once used to exist on this planet. But people kind of want to go back to that in some sense. Romantics, they have a romance about nature. They look back on the past like it's some idyllic thing that we can recover that somehow modern man has drifted away from, particularly because of Christian and Jewish influences. So this was sort of this romance with nature against Judeo-Christian values, against the Bible, and they use the natural theology, and they believe that nature was imbued with almost divine qualities in the sense that God himself was nature. And so they wanted to commune with nature, and in communing with nature, have a love affair with nature, so to speak. As they commune with nature, they also commune with God. And this was a very typical sentiment you see throughout what we call the Romantic movement, especially in Germany, but we had it in our own country too. It was not as virulent as it was in our own country as it was in Germany. It was not as anti-Semitic. Romanticism really began with a man named Goethe, and we have several important figures after that, very popular for about 50 years. And then that's what we would call environmentalism in the 1800s. We would call it Romanticism. And one of the most important things about Romanticism that really is not a good thing, in my opinion, is that they emphasized your feelings, your will, and your emotions as being more important than your mind, than your thought. And so this was a bigger, perhaps even a bigger problem, because now people stop thinking. The world itself is more than just your mind. So Romantics wanted to emphasize all of life, holism, which they believe was better to be involved with all of life. And so they used that really as an attack against the human mind. Mm. And they also did not like the scientific technology that was being used to destroy nature. So this was part of their operation to set aside what they considered to be the worship of reason that needed to be set down a few pegs. And of course, they would insert their own emotions and their own instincts and their own ideas about how to run the world. It wouldn't be necessarily based on reason, but also based on the whole of man, like his emotions and his biology, his instincts, all these types of things. And so reason was dethroned. And there's a truth in here, because obviously reason was worshipped. But the problem wasn't reason per se. The problem was that people worshipped that reason, and that reason was fallen, which they did not understand. And if we need to get our hearts and our reasoning straightened out, we have to get back to the Word of God, which is what, of course, no one was doing, particularly in Germany in the 1800s. They were moving away from God on all fronts. So even though they may have rejected some Enlightenment features, they adopted Romanticism. And our emotions, our hearts, our instincts, our biology is just as fallen as our minds. And so it really did not solve problems. In fact, it made problems even worse. And then you can't even think anymore, because your mind is no longer able to rationalize things correctly. In fact, you don't even care about such things. Yeah. And part of the madness that we see in our modern world really goes back to these romantic ideals. You see a lot of foolishness being presented right and left, and I mean that literally, politically as well. It's because people have stopped thinking. They have trees in their heads. They have animals in their heads, they haven't. Certainly don't have the Bible in their heads, that's for sure, nor the history of the Bible, which is also very important. These things have been rejected, and what are you left with? You're left with nature. And then your ethics will be the laws of the jungle, see, because without God, right and wrong, okay, you're left with what is this world, nature itself, and nature becomes the arbiter of all nature. And then that's intertwined, and you've thrown reason. It puts people in a very serious predicament. Yeah. That's where we are. And the Nazis have taken us through that once before in a very horrific sense, and on a scale that was even much worse than what we see today. But you can see if environmentalism continues in the way it's going, its anti-human trajectory, if these things are not slowed down, we could approach something similar to kind of kinds of activities we saw during the World War II.
I was going to make that observation, Mark. Everything that you just described and explained in the last several minutes, we see the seeds of that today, and I agree with your conclusion. If we don't stop this, if we don't stand against it, then we're going to see more horrific things against humanity that we've seen in the past. So let me take this moment just to summarize where we've been, what I've captured, and just for our readers' sake. So the Nazis believed that getting back to nature would somehow right all of the world's wrongs. Getting rid of the Jews and Christians was a priority because they helped the poor and the oppressed, and that actually worked against Darwinism and its offshoot eugenics. So is that an accurate summary, Mark?
Precisely, yes. Here's a quotation from a Nazi biology professor. His name was Ernst Lehmann. He died in 1957. And just listen to the quotation here, and you'll be amazed at how apropos it is for us today, too, in spite of the fact that he's a Nazi. But notice here, we recognize that separating humanity from nature, from the whole of life, see, that there's that holism I discussed, the oneness, the monism, as we discussed earlier, leads to humankind's own destruction and to the death of nations. And they are particularly upset with Jews and Christians here because they view Jews and Christians as anti-nature. Aliens, almost, especially the Jewish people. Only through a reintegration of humanity into the whole of nature can our people get stronger. Now, there you see the eugenics, the biology that they're trying to emphasize. That is the fundamental point of the biological attacks of our age. Humankind alone is no longer the focus of thought, but rather life as a whole. See, there again, there's that holism. I would argue that fascism means holism. That's what it means. A lot of discussion about holism today. It's everywhere.
Yes.
And really, that's a fascist worldview. See? Yes. And everything he's saying about the whole of life.
Right.
And of course, that doesn't allow man to be made in God's image and doesn't allow God to be sovereign over history and over creation.
Yes.
This striving toward connectedness with the totality of life, with nature itself, and nature into which we are born, this is the deepest meaning and the true essence of National Socialist thought. So if you want to understand National Socialism, you have to understand its interest in nature. And one of the most grievous things that I see going on today with regard to all discussions about Nazism is how few people talk about the ideology. It's almost non-existent. Very few people understand even what Nazis believed. I mean, it's almost like there's a lot of discussions, I would call them almost glib presentations of their racism, because they don't really understand that the Nazis believed that science was teaching them racism, that nature was teaching them racism,
yes,
that their worship of nature led them in that direction, and that Darwin gave them the right to have the idea of the laws of the jungle prevail.
Yes.
And these are things that are not a part of the discussion when people talk about Nazis. When most people think of Nazis today, at least from the mainstream media, they think that you're a Christian or you're some kind of a right-winger, whatever that may mean. These are all false caricatures. It's got nothing to do with reality, what was going on in the German mind in the 1800s, and especially in the 1900s.
Yes.
So we see these ideas, and they're still with us today. And the Nazis were, for example, they 1933, the first order of business, they passed a animal rights law, and that animal rights law was anti-Semitic because they did not like how the Jews performed what they called kosher slaughter. The Jews call it too, but the Jews have special rules. They want to make sure that the blood is out of the meat, so they, when they kill animals for slaughter, they do so under different pretexts and for different purposes. And the Nazis considered that to be very mean and cruel. So basically, they outlawed kosher slaughter. Another part of this problem with the 33 law is that they outlawed, almost, not quite, they had to kind of re-regulate it and permit it, animal experimentation. And what's interesting to me is that later on, during the war, they were using Jews primarily as experimental animals. it's just shocking, you know, that you have this law passed in 33, and then later on during the war, you're going to use people, especially the Jewish people who were considered, you know, unhuman, whatever you want to call them, almost anti-nature. They're just like the vermin, this type of stuff, how they described them, weeds, that they did, you know, experimentations on them, you know, massive experimentation on them.
Yeah,
so you have this incongruence. Secondly, the trains that were sent to these death camps in which many people, Jewish people, died. On the same, many of these same trains, you had animals on them. And part of the same 33 Nazi laws is that you had very strict rules on how animals were to be cared for. A certain amount of water, a certain amount of space, made sure they had to be fed. And the police battalions in charge of these trains were scolded for not taking care of the animals. Meanwhile, the Jews, okay, they were stuffed in these cars, you know, like sardines. How many Jews can fit into a railroad car? One more. And they had no care whatsoever. So this 1933 animal rights law is actually a very important, you know, how do we put it? Very ironic, I would say the least, you know, something very sinister, that this was all turned around and used against the Jews. It was a very anti-Semitic law. And also very important as a part of this process, the transition, we see in 1939, 1940, a famous documentary film called The Eternal Jew. And of course, the idea of the Eternal Jew, he's eternal, he's up in the sky, he has no, he's no earthly good. This is sort of their ideas as they viewed the Jewish people. The climax of this famous documentary, infamous documentary, is that they focus on the kosher slaughter of the Jews for 15, 20 minutes. And they actually show pictures of how the Jewish people did this, allegedly did this. And they criticized how evil it was and how barbaric it was. And then right after that, these scenes of the blood and gore of these animals dying, they show the Fuhrer for the first time. They praise the Fuhrer for being a, you know, wonderful animal lover and for rescuing Germany from such, you know, terrible practices. And then right after that, he shows up in the Reichstag, and he's going to send the Jews to hell if they start another world war. So that whole animal rights is actually fundamental to some extent with regard to the Holocaust. It's an undercurrent that plays a powerful role in the justification for the extermination of the Jews. And then, of course, you have other laws, too. You have hunting laws were passed that basically are still with us in the books today across the world. They have adopted many of the same Nazi policies that Hermann Göring, he was a lover of the hunt, but he also loved nature. He was a worshiper of nature almost. He loved animals, particularly predators. So did Hitler. The Never Cry Wolf cult really began in Germany. He loved wolves. Interesting, Aldo Leopold, he's our, what we call the deep ecologist in America. You know, he said to think like a mountain. And this kind of goes back to our earlier discussion about thinking. You think like a mountain. That's really the environmental battle cry for today. And that means you stop thinking. You think like a rock. And it means you're not going to be thinking too much at all. But this really is at the heart of all kinds of problems today in our society. Aldo Leopold, he wanted to go to Nazi Germany in 1935, and he did. He was paid. The Nazis paid him to go, and he wanted to see the new environmental direction that the Nazis were taking. And he criticized a few things, but overall he was actually very complimentary of what the Nazis were doing in their new green direction. So he goes there, and he also drags home the Never Cry Wolf cult from Nazi Germany, because that was a very important thing the Nazis were emphasizing. They were the first country in the world to protect wolves, even though they didn't have any. So this whole discussion about wolves, this goes back to Nazi Germany as well. Hitler loved wolves. He viewed himself as the Uncle Wolf. You know, that's how he wanted to be called. Many of the names that you see in World War II, for example, some of the headquarters for the war, like in Poland, they called it the Wolf's Lair. In Ukraine, it was called Werewolf. You think of the submarines that they were using out there in the Atlantic Ocean to sink all kinds of American and British ships. They were called the Wolfpack. The Volkswagen was made in the Wolfsburg. You know, Hitler loved wolves. And so wolf was something that he valued and something that he even called the SS his pack of wolves. So basically the SS were the pack of wolves that went after the Jews. And they were going to clean up the herd, the German herd. That's what wolves supposedly do, according to this Never Cry Wolf cult. They go after the weak, and they make the nation strong, and they make the herd strong. And Hitler viewed himself as a very wolf that was going to do this. And then what's really interesting to me is that it has Holocaust connections too, in my mind. I really can't prove this, but as I think about the Nazi mindset, after they got done with what is called Operation Reinhardt, this is where up to 3 million Jewish people were killed in death camps like Treblinka, Sobibor, and Belzec. There's a few other camps as well that maybe not quite as many people were killed. This is not Auschwitz. It's called Operation Reinhardt, a little bit farther away from Auschwitz. But basically, they destroyed almost all of Polish Jewry in these camps. And when they got done, at least in Treblinka or it's in Sobibor, I think probably all three of them, but I can't prove that, is that they planted lupin flowers on top of the Jewish graves after they got done. Lupins are wolf flowers. And so it's almost like, okay, we've done our job, and the wolves have cleaned up the herd, and we're going to put wolf flowers on top of the graves of the Jewish people. So you have this really environmentalism going on. You got wolves, you got animal rights, and then you have this directed, specifically targeted against the Jews in a very horrific way, almost like environmental social justice. And my view, the reason why the Jews were in ghettos is precisely because the same reason. They're just city people. They're dirty city people. All they do is sell things. They do, you know, they don't know how to work. And we're just going to put them in the ghetto where they belong, without parks. And part of the, you know, the dirt and the stench of those ghettos was almost like another form of environmental social justice. So that you have these laws. But that's not the only laws. Then you have hunting laws. You also have forestry laws. The Nazis loved, they loved trees. And the Germans did too. In fact, they passed they called a Dauerwald, which means eternal forest. Really, it's the birth of what we call sustainable forestry. And really, the Nazis viewed themselves as almost like the German people as a strong forest. And what you have to do is kind of clean up some of the weak, and it's very similar to the eugenics. And then you make the trees strong. And of course, this is also directed against Jewish people because they view Jews as city people again. Then you have another law was passed in 1935, which is they really didn't use it as much as they could have, but today this kind of stuff is all over the place. It's the idea of social engineering over private property. They call it the Right Nature Protection Act. And in other words, it's one thing to regulate what goes on up in a park up in the mountains where nobody lives. Okay, if you start doing this, however, where people live over private property and environmental rules dictate what you can do on your property, where was that idea born? That was born again in Nazi Germany, 1935, the Reich Nature Protection Act. So a lot of these things we see today in our society that were first politically applied in Nazi Germany, the ideas preceded National Socialism, so they didn't invent it. However, they were first put into political practice on a probably the biggest scale at that time, the 1930s. And the Nazi regime was the greenest regime on the planet in the 1930s by far. So you see this green stuff going on, and then you see this anti-Semitism at the same time. It's part of the same, mindset, and their idea: let's get back to nature, social Darwinism, biology, eugenics, but also that included environmentalism, because if we want to purify the race, we have to purify nature too. Also, in World War II, they were going to clean up the Eastern Territory. So their idea, after they destroyed the Jewish people, and of course the Poles and the Slavic people in Russia, they were going to take over that land and then convert that into really a garden park, what Hitler called the Park of Extraordinary Beauty, and they were going to turn that whole area into a garden park of what we would call sustainability. The Nazis were also the inventors of what we call sustainability, and of course this is being trumpeted everywhere today. It's just amazing that all these things, and I'm not talking about metaphors here. I'm not talking about eco-fascism as a metaphor. I'm talking about as a historical fact. And so many people want to use the communists as the ultimate, you know, today, if you're hearing this all the time, these eco-Marxists, you know, and this is just ridiculous, because the Marxists, they were humanist, okay? They were emphasized in progress. They wanted to build all kinds of things, and of course the Nazis were a little bit different. They had technology too, but they emphasized sustainability. So it was a little bit different program, and that's the kind of program trajectory we're on today. It's more of a fascist operation, and the idea of holism, nature, is at the heart of that. It may not be racist today, but I would also argue that many of the things we teach with regard to multiculturalism, I would call multiculturalism today multi-tribalism.
Yes.
So they're hiding their racism in the multi-tribalism. And I grew up, you know, that I remember as a kid is that they really emphasized, and that really goes back to Judeo-Christian values where your ethnicity no longer matters. For example, in Galatians chapter 3, no longer matters whether you're Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, we're all one in Christ Jesus. And that was sort of secularized in America with regard to our country. The ideal is that people lose their ethnicity and they become Americans. And so that is no longer in vogue today. What you have is a multiculturalism, multi-tribalism, and that is being used to really dethrone the melting pot and also Judeo-Christian values, universal values. This is also part of the Nazi enterprise. They wanted to get rid of universal values. They believed the Jews were instigators, the originators of universal values. And there are no universal values. There's only racism. There are only the laws of the jungle. There's only biology and instincts. And whoever's the strongest, he's the best, and that's it.
Yes.
And, this was their worldview.
Yes.
And this is something that a lot of people simply don't understand or don't know. They don't realize that there was a justification based on nature as to why the Nazis were doing what they were doing, and people need to know this.
Yes, yeah, and that's perfect. That's perfect, Mark. We're going to take a break here, folks, for a word from our sponsors. But listen, when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the philosophers that influenced Hitler and Nazism. All of this, Mark just said, it all has a basis and a foundation, and they didn't just invent this stuff. They learned it from their philosophers, and they adapted it for their ideas and what they wanted the Third Reich to be. So we'll be back to talk about that in just a moment. Here's a word from our sponsors.
Clean Foods for You is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our stringent quality controls and absolute zero GMO and testing for heavy metals makes us unique in the storable foods market. Try our products today and join the many others in discovering the best clean foods available in the storable food market. Order online at www.cleanfoodsforyou.com.
Dr. Mike Spalding has hit a home run with his new book, #MTPGA, Make the Pulpit Great Again. 12 things Christians can do right now. In Make the Pulpit Great Again, Dr. Spalding has addressed some of the gravest ills plaguing the American pulpit. Only through a policy of complacency and compromise adopted by the nation's pastors has the once great United States ceded the moral high ground and set the standard for the rest of the world in pornography, addiction, privation, and the murder of untold millions killed in state-sponsored, taxpayer-funded abortion mills. The words in Dr. Spalding's book contain the secret to restoring this country to her former glory. For if we are ever to make America great again, we must first have a national call to repentance by our church leaders. We must make the pulpit great again. Available on Amazon and other retail sellers.
Hi friends, Works LLC is a manufacturer of custom-made holsters, mag carriers, knife sheaths, and accessories. Works is your one-stop shop for high-quality inside or outside the waistband concealed carry holster. Works LLC is a Christian and family-owned and operated company that values made in the USA. They are a proud sponsor of Soaring Eagle Radio. Visit Works LLC, www.werkz.com, works.com, and when you do, tell Shan that you heard about them on Soaring Eagle Radio. Works LLC, 855-937-5901. 855-937-5901. Works LLC. Hi, folks. Thanks for checking out our sponsors and telling them thank you for supporting Soaring Eagle Radio. Mark, we were leading up to this point earlier. When we were talking about the Nazi green ideology, and it's really based on some of the philosophers that rose up in Germany, and I know that you write in your book that Schopenhauer was one of Hitler's favorite, if not his favorite philosopher, just ahead of a Nietzsche. Why is that important to know, first of all, Mark, and then I know that you'll explain why that's troubling.
Schopenhauer and Nietzsche were Hitler's favorite philosophers. And you want to highlight philosophers. He had other favorite authors, too. You know, he loved Carl May, for example. Carl May, he's always presented as a Western writer, which is true in America, but they're actually anti-cowboy Westerns. kind of the Westerns we see today on film really go back to Carl May. Interesting, you know, in my view, Hollywood died in 1971 when John Wayne died, and the old classic Westerns are no longer with us. Now it's the anti-Western that we see, and Carl May really is the originator of such things. In fact, they made a few Westerns named after Carl May. They called them sauerkraut Westerns in 1950s.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, then you later on, you had the Clint Eastwood Westerns, the spaghetti Westerns.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And those are almost semi-fascist Westerns, too. They're anti-Westerns in strange ways. But Hitler loved Carl May. He also loved Richard Wagner. Okay, he was a composer. And he loved his music, and he also loved his philosophy, which Wagner got from Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. And so Schopenhauer is very important, and so is Nietzsche. And now we'll talk about a new ism. We talked about romanticism, a romance with nature, the idea that biology and instincts are more important than thought, and that nature, I can commune with nature. On top of that, and hardened, is a hardened form of romanticism. We call it existentialism. And the Germans were really the primary instigators of this movement as well. They emphasized what we call existence, and existence being more important, again, than my mind, than my thought. And Schopenhauer especially was the guru who came up with, really laid the foundations of what we call existentialism. And I know it is true, a lot of existentialists, they try to say that we believe that we emphasize individual freedom. The problem is, and which they don't understand or appreciate, is that they use existence itself as the only arbiter of meaning. So what happens is you're put back into the circle of life that you can't get out of. You lose your freedom in the process. Because when we talk about holism again, this whole of nature, existence, okay, we can't get out of that according to romantic ideas and according to social Darwinist views. Well, the same is true for existential views, because they don't believe that God exists. They don't believe man is made in God's image. So you cannot escape existence. And so actually they work against freedom. And what happens, I become a slave to the world in which I live in. And then, of course, most existentialists, as romantics, they like environmental laws, which are usually very restrictive on top of it. And the idea of a holistic one, I can't get out of this. This becomes very important for existentialists too. So they may emphasize what I would call a limited form of individual freedom, but in the end, they're taken over by the holistic view of life. And probably a better way to look at holism, think of a different word. Think of it this way. It's totalism. And then if you think of totalism, okay, we're not too far from totalitarianism. And once we understand totalitarianism, now we're back to fascism. So if you use life itself, all of life, as the only arbiter of meaning, we are really getting ourselves in trouble. We're using a totalistic, totalitarian worldview to determine what is the truth. And this is a big part of the problem with both romanticism and what I would call existentialism. So that's an aside. I know there's all kinds of discussions. What is existentialism? Basically, existence is more important than you. It's more important than your thought, especially. And existentialists, like romantics, really emphasized emotions, but what's unique, and biology and instincts more important than your thought, but what's unique about the existentialists, they emphasize the will. The will is more important than your thought. So with the romantics, they emphasize my feelings are more important than thought. Now with the existentialists, the primary difference was it's my will. So Schopenhauer was the man that said will is really the essence of nature. It's in everything. So it's not that God made the world and that man is made in God's image and that nature reflects the glory of God. No, that's not it. Will is really the all-pervasive part of life that's everywhere. So animals have will, man has will, plants and animals, they have will. Even to some extent, he believed that the rocks even had will too. I won't get into that whole discussion, but still, the idea of will becomes really critical in existentialist thought. And what was the Nazis emphasized in the 1930s? The triumph of the will. Okay. So this was a very important doctrine to them. It's not what you think, it's what you will to be. And we have a lot of this going on today too in our society. I mean, your thought is really not what's important, it's what you will to be the case. And again, these are all German ideas coming out of Germany, very strong in those days. They went through the National Socialist experiment as well, absorbed and used in a very horrific way. And Schopenhauer was Hitler's favorite philosopher, very pessimistic philosopher. But what's important about Schopenhauer, not only is the will that he emphasized willpower, but also his animal rights, as we talked about earlier. Why were the Nazis so interested in animal rights? Well, this goes back to Schopenhauer. He was the original animal rights guru of the modern world, and very anti-Semitic on top of it. In fact, every time Schopenhauer started talking about Jews, he blew a gasket. So here's some quotations from Schopenhauer, and what he wanted to do was, again, he was atheist, he was anti-Christian, he was anti-Semitic, anti-Bible, and he wanted to explain everything, again, apart from biblical values, apart from anything outside, no outside sources from God. And he also wanted to build ethics upon it too. And this ethics will be based on nature. And he said that if we're nice to animals, then we'll be nice to people too. Interesting. A difference, see, that's an upside down ethics.
Yes.
You know, we know from the Bible, from New Testament, Old Testament, we love neighbor as ourself. You know, we love God and we love our neighbor as ourself. That's the biblical mandate. In Schopenhauer, it's like reverse. You love your animals and you're going to love people, because he viewed people as basically animals anyway. So you see all these problems connected to this.
Yes.
So now he's going to build an ethics on this. By the way, there is a proverb that says if you're good to your animals, that's a good thing. But still, it's without any reference to God. But notice some of these quotations from Arthur Schopenhauer. He lived back in the 1800s, excuse me. Here's a quotation. We owe the animals not mercy but justice, and the debt often remains unpaid in Europe. So now we're looking for environmental social justice here. Wow.
Wow.
The debt often remains unpaid in Europe, the continent that is permeated with the Jews. It is obviously high time in Europe that Jewish views on nature should be expelled from Europe. There's no question that Hitler knew this verse. He knew he could apparently quote Schopenhauer verbatim. Now here's another quotation, same guy. The fault lies with the Jewish view that regards the animal as something manufactured for man's use. This is Genesis 1. Man is made in God's image, and Adam names all the animals, and he abuses all the animals. That's how he views it. This is a Jewish view of nature that needs to be expelled from Europe. Then now he blames the Bible. These are the effects of Genesis 1. And generally the whole Jewish way of looking at nature. So, these are actual quotations from this man. And, of course, Schopenhauer was Hitler's favorite philosopher. He could, again, quote them. And then Wagner, his favorite musician, he loved Schopenhauer. And then Nietzsche follows Schopenhauer. And so he's going to emphasize the will even more. Here we have the death of God theology type stuff that Nietzsche emphasized. And he followed Schopenhauer's emphasis on the will as well. In fact, he emphasized it even more than Schopenhauer did.
Yes.
Now, Nietzsche wasn't necessarily an animal rights guru or anything like that, but still, he emphasized existence and the earth over human thought.
Yes.
Again, this goes back to our discussion where feelings are more important than thought. Well, again, now it's the will more important than thought. So what you will is more important than what you think. And this is true with regard to your philosophy, but also your ethics.
Yes.
See,
yeah.
It's willpower.
Yeah. Now, Mark.
And so this led to nothing but trouble in the mindsets of many in Germany in the 1800s.
Yeah. Now, coupled with that too, was an abandonment of the Bible, biblical theology, and so on. So on the theological side, we find Friedrich Schleiermacher. So again, another key figure that influenced Hitler's thinking. So who was Schleiermacher, and how did the Nazis adapt his work?
Well, they didn't adapt his work per se, but he helped to contribute to the rise of National Socialism in a very strange way, because Schleiermacher, his theology was really not biblical. It was a more of a natural theology, and he tried to merge the Romantic movement with sort of a Germanized Christianity. And this Germanized Christianity had some Christian ideas, of course, in it, you know, a lot of them, but they're uprooted from the Jewish background of the Old Testament. So he wanted to separate Christianity from the Jewish foundations, and so they're going to sort of get rid of the Jewish history. And he was one of the first theologians to do this, and many of the theologians that followed Schleiermacher in the 1800s, they did the same thing. They were trying to de-Judify the Bible because they viewed the Bible as something which was too particularistic, too Jewish, too interesting, too materialistic in their minds, because in the Jewish Bible you have emphasis on history, and they don't want to be tied to history. They want to be able to think freely. Kant, for example, another, you know, Schleiermacher followed him very closely. Kant also wanted to emphasize the fact that, and he also was very anti-Semitic. And once he started talking about Jews, he blew a gasket. His idea was to euthanize Jewishness, Jewish doctrines and theology from German life. He actually said that, euthanize it. We need to euthanize Jewishness from German culture. And it's incredible to me that it was euthanasia experts during the World War II that actually designed the death camps that killed the Jews. And, you know, it's almost like the devil has his prophets too. Even though Kant would have been shocked by all the things that Hitler later did, still, Kant laid the foundations for what we call the Romantic movement. Schleiermacher followed him very closely. And the idea of euthanizing Jewishness is precisely what the whole theological liberalism was doing during the 1800s. And as they euthanized Jewishness, they took out the Bible itself. And what we're left is sort of with an esoteric German Christianity that was sort of like the Kingdom Now type stuff you see going on in our society today in America.
Yes.
And we're going to usher in sort of a Christian culture that's going to save, you know, save the world. The problem is that all died in the trench warfare of World War One. And after World War One is over, the religious romanticism is now gone. And all we're left with now is the secular romanticism, existentialism. And now it becomes really mean. Yes. And so Schleiermacher was not followed by Hitler in any way, but the program they developed laid the seed, you know, laid the foundations for the destruction of biblical Christianity. And then once biblical Christianity really essentially died in World War One, in the trench warfare of that, even though it was already pretty much dead even by then, when the outfall of that war was all said and done, when things were come out of that war, everything is very secular. And now there's no reference to God at all. Things become completely godless. So what could be worse than Schleiermacher's, you know, romanticism mixture with theology? Well, how about, you know, romanticism with no reference to God at all? So that's what happened. You have a totally secular culture now. And now there's no rules whatsoever in terms of, you know, given from God from the outside. And now man can act any way he wants to. And what matters primarily is his will, what we will to be the case. And so these really doctrines snowballed over time.
Yeah.
And then the Nazis are going to take them all and absorb them all, put them into their own concoction, of course. And it just becomes, it just blows up all of Europe.
Yeah. Now, I don't think, Mark, that it's an understatement at all to say that the church today in America particularly has succumbed to some of these same influences that resulted in a secularized, really dead, apostate church in Germany. And one of those things is the devaluing of human life. It is shocking to me the number of professing believers and their churches, heads of churches, that are marching in pro-abortion demonstrations and parades. They're photographed. They're written about, proclaiming that abortion is from God and so on and so forth. I think this is evidence of some of the seeds that were sown back in the 30s and 40s, bearing fruit even today in America, or is that an overstatement, Mark?
Mark. Well, what's happened, like I said, at the beginning of the hour, we talked about racism and environmentalism was very popular in the 1800s, early 1900s. Now it's overpopulation. So now you don't have the racism, but you do have the overpopulation. And abortion, of course, is accepted because the idea is there's too many people. And so in that sense, I would connect it in that sense. And of course, the devaluation of life goes back to even though the romantics and the existentialists wanted to value all of life, once you take out God out of the question, there is no life. You know, in fact, you know, Solomon tells us regularly in Proverbs, without God and his word and his wisdom, we're all in death. And so what you have is really lots of death cults that are being propagated.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the abortion is it's a death cult. You know, and we live in a culture emphasizing death today. It's just, you know, really strange. You know, the suicide thing, you know, is growing.
Yes.
Today, and death. You know, social Darwinism is a matter of the idea that life comes from death. You know, and so you know these are all not good things. You know, they're valuing death. Even environmentalists do this too. You know, the dead trees help to create new trees and all this kind of stuff. So you have all kinds of death being almost like the creator of life, which is a contradiction. But that's what we're being taught.
Well, it certainly
is. Yes, I would agree with you. Yes, yeah, to some extent. Okay. You have to explain a little bit more, but yes.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I've noticed too is that Hollywood is falling right in line with the same kind of ecological, green theology, really, green ideology, and some of the movies that they put out are clearly meant to lift up the environment, lift up nature, worship nature, in fact, and I'm sure that you can think of a couple. I'm thinking especially of James Cameron's Avatar. That was a salute to green ideology, wasn't it?
Yes, of course, and there is a connection between James Cameron and the Nazi movement in the sense that he loved Leni Riefenstahl. And Leni Riefenstahl was a very famous producer, you know, director in the 1930s. She produced, like we already mentioned, The Triumph of the Will. And that was her famous movie that supposedly was the greatest documentary of all time for quite some time, and not in the sense that it was great in terms of what it featured, but in terms of how it was filmed. And he loved Leni Riefenstahl and her and how she made movies and how she emphasized certain things. And so a lot of things that there are influences from Leni Riefenstahl that shows up in James Cameron's work. And Leni Riefenstahl was also an environmentalist. She was all connected to many of the she made a lot of nature movies, for example, during her tenure. And Triumph of the Will was her trademark. But she also made other movies too, and documentaries as well.
Well, before we run out of time for this conversation, Mark, and by the way, folks, we have only scratched just barely scratching the surface. Again, I'm talking with author Mark Musser. It's Nazi Oaks, The Green Sacrifice of the Judeo-Christian Worldview in the Holocaust. Get your copy. It's probably on Amazon. Do you have a website, Mark?
I do. The website is rmarkmuster.com. So rmarkmuster.com.
So check out
the book.
Website.
Is you can buy it anywhere online. I will say, however, I'm sorry to say this, but I'm going to change the name of the book. It's going to be called Nazi Ecology.
Ah.
It's going to come out next week. And it's called, the subtitle is The Oak Sacrifice of the Judeo-Christian Worldview in the Holocaust. But it's coming out, a new book next week, new title called Nazi Ecology.
Nazi Ecology. There you go, folks. Same.
But you can still buy Nazi Oaks. You can. It's okay. I'm not sure when they're going to retire. Probably pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, in what time we have left, I have to ask. I know our listeners are probably wondering, where does the oak tree come into play? It's prominent in the old title. It's still in the new title. Where does the oak tree come into play in the Nazi worldview?
Well, the Nazi worldview, they loved oak trees as well, and oaks was very important to them. Oaks represent the beauty, power, and sacrifice, and it goes back to pagan ideas. In fact, we see it even in the Old Testament as well, where human beings were sacrificed underneath the oak trees. It mentioned the book of Isaiah, other places. The pagans did this too in Germany. Oaks were considered sacred, and the oak groves were sacred places. And the Nazis were well aware of such activities. And it's my view, it's my thesis. Again, I can't prove it. It's a lot of circumstantial evidence. But my thesis is that the Holocaust is like almost like a human sacrifice of the Jewish people underneath the oak trees. And, there are oak trees, actually, interestingly enough, some of the death camps, even at Auschwitz, Nazis value. And that's a little bit different discussion, takes some more explanation, yes. But the oaks,
yeah.
It's also part of this whole love infatuation with nature.
Yes, yeah. Well, Mark, maybe we'll circle back and do this again soon and try to talk about some more of your research. It's a fantastic book, folks. You got to get it. Nazi Ecology, that's the new title, Nazi Ecology, that's coming out in another week. But pick up the book on Amazon, on his website. It's Barnes & Noble, wherever you shop, it's out there. Mark, thank you so much for joining me today on Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. God bless you. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter @SoaringEagleRad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.SoaringEagleRadio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, PastorMike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.